Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 688.RO1311, certificate number 53610, The King Under the Mountain. Is that Durin?
Finally, we're doing a show about Thorin Oakenshield.
Oh, good.
Well, all the Thorin heads, we've got your letters, we've heard you, we've got your postcards.
You're like, why no dwarves?
There's no. We need more Thrain representation. No, this is not that King Under the Mountain. Although I have to admit, I probably wouldn't have called the show that if not for Tolkien.
Oh, this is
verbiage being in my head.
This is as people are sorting through our 6,000 shows. You're like, oh God, what's the hook here?
Please listen to Figwit if you're hoping for Tolkien nerd stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Well, also the Beatles. What was the Beatles Tolkien show?
What do we call it? The Beatles Lord of the Rings? Yeah. Maybe it was called the Beatles Lord of the Rings.
There we go. Well done.
So after you listen to those, you can come back and listen to this one that will have nothing to do with the work of J.R.R. Tolkien. Professor Tolkien, we call him Professor.
Professor.
Just Tolkien. To show our respect to a man who's been dead for 50 years.
Three rings.
Professor. He wasn't just writing just escapist stuff. He was a professor.
Well, you know, his son is really involved, or is it his grandson? The Tolkiens are still deeply involved
Isn't there a bit of
exploitation of his estate?
I think there's a bit of a schism. I feel like his son was the one that edited all the stuff. His son Christopher edited all the stuff, but there's some grandson who's actually the consultant on all the Hollywood stuff because
the more academic side
of the family would not approve. They don't think there should be an Amazon show.
Have you been watching the Swords and Sorcery of the Amazon?
I saw the first season, which maybe wasn't good. There's a second season that's maybe better. I don't know.
There's a second season.
You're not into that either?
Well, I
why are you watching this?
I am watching it because I'm being basically coerced into watching it by people.
Because House of the Dragon's not coming back for years?
Yeah. Well, and House of the Dragon also I was forced to watch. The people with whom I make a family love media and consume it. And
they don't know how much you hate media.
Well, they do. They hear about it all the time. They know that, you know, I'm the one that has to be dragged.
You're like, why must people make art?
Can't I just go do things?
Please stop making it.
I have tennis balls to stack. And they're like, sit on the couch and watch this Swords and Sorcery show.
You need to care about if the Greens are going to retake the King's Landing.
Exactly. So I have watched it, and I just watched an episode a couple of nights ago, and I was like, in the middle of the episode, I'm the guy sitting on the couch where I was like, this is incomprehensible. This is so poorly written. And they're like, shut up. I'm like, this makes no sense. This guy was over here, and now he's over there.
Maybe I should not watch season two.
You'll be fine without it. How about that?
So instead of made up pan-European mythology, we're going to do real pan-European mythology.
How do you know? Is it his story?
It's almost entirely. Oh, no, wait. There is one queen under the mountain.
Oh, good.
I'm looking at my list now.
Good, good, good.
Thank you. It seems a little bit of a token because there's only one.
A Tolkien?
Yeah, we have a Tolkien queen. I was in...
Tolkien queen?
I was in... I don't even know what song that's supposed to be.
Caribbean.
It wasn't Dancing Queen. Oh, okay. There we go. I was in Denmark over the summer. Is that a humble brag?
I don't know. I wasn't in Denmark over the summer.
Did you walk across Denmark? It's very easy.
I was in the wrong direction.
Just in a couple... You could probably walk across Denmark in a couple days.
Maybe I'll do it.
Maybe you can't. There was a Mads Mikkelsen Western last year where the premise is... It's like a Danish Western. The premise is that he's trying to set up shop and fight the outlaws in uncolonizable central Jutland.
Yeah. Well, and there's enough islands you'd have to be.
I just mean the peninsular part.
Oh, I see.
What's the narrowest part of Denmark? Well, I know what the narrowest part of the Øresund is between Denmark and southern Sweden, because that's where we went. We took a train about an hour north of Copenhagen to Kronborg Castle, which I think in the English speaking world we think of as Elsinore, because that's what Shakespeare calls it in Hamlet.
Oh, sure.
In fact, that's not the name of the castle. That's the name of the town, Helsingør. But there's been a castle there for a long time because it's the strait where Sweden and Denmark are the closest. And so I think both nations, when they were separate nations, had outposts, their fortresses. They're mostly just to tax cargo coming through the strait.
They're separate nations now.
They are now.
Yeah.
They weren't always, right?
No, they weren't. Well, and this is also what keeps the Germans from having a good navy in World War II. They couldn't, they have to go through this.
They have Hamburg.
Well, I know, but they weren't able to put a navy to sea without the British sinking it.
Right.
Because they
luckily. And that's why this podcast is in English.
Right, exactly.
This Kronborg Castle it's pretty great. I mean, it doesn't look like a craggy castle. It looks more like at this point it's been rebuilt and it's a 19th century palace of some kind with, I think, lots of nicely appointed rooms where you can see where the last royals lived, whoever lived there. I don't remember.
And the royals did live there. It wasn't just an armored fort. It was a fancy place.
It was also an armored fort. It's got emplacements facing the strait and three moats, I want to say. I feel like we crossed a moat and got to a different moat and then we got to another moat and finally we were in the castle.
Is it built like in a star formation? Those were really great.
Yeah, I like
Hanseatic.
We were wandering one of those in Copenhagen. What's the star-shaped fort there in Copenhagen proper? The Kastellet near the Little Mermaid. I think it is a weird, I think it is kind of a, let me look at, can I see the moats of Kronborg Castle? Aerially? I don't know. Anyway, they really play on the Hamlet connection there.
Right.
As you can imagine. Like, I think Hamlet was performed in the Elsinore Courtyard, like, surprisingly early, like, to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Shakespeare's death.
Whoa.
Like, so in the, what is that? The early 1800s, yeah. I guess?
Well,
yeah, I think it would have been 1816. And then since then, they do Hamlet there all the time. Gielgud did Hamlet there. Jude Law did Hamlet there. There's a lot of the signs are, there's like a kids tour, I think. There's signage up that kind of is trying to get kids interested in the idea of going to this possibly slightly dull Danish palace that says stuff like, "Who killed old King Hamlet?" As if Hamlet's a whodunit, you know?
Yeah.
Boy, I hope we get to the bottom of that.
And as though kids are like, "Oh, King Hamlet. Yeah. Tell me more."
Because you know what kids love? Old King Hamlet. Not even the main guy with the skull. They're like, "What about his dead dad?
Yeah.
What's his deal?
What about King Hamlet who comes on Christmas Eve and brings us?"
It did seem like no one had actually read the play, which begins with the ghost of old King Hamlet being like, "My brother killed me." It's not a very good whodunit. But I remember at one point we were kind of wandering around the courtyard. Jude Law was not doing Hamlet, luckily.
Darn.
No.
Oh, what do you mean, luckily?
Who needs to see a balding 50-year-old Hamlet?
He's balding? I didn't know
what
that.
What a terrible way for you to find out.
Oh, Jude Law, very famously handsome.
Great actor. We love Jude Law. But he's got one of those English heads of hair that he did not hold on to for very long.
Oh, it's starting to go back like an Elon Musk.
So... we were kind of wandering in the courtyard and somebody's explaining something. And so we kind of stand behind this group listening to this guy, and then he wanders into the chapel and starts explaining some of the royal initials painted in the royal box up there, and we're listening, and then he walks to a different door, and then he turns to us and he says, "You are not on the paid tour. You cannot come here."
Oh.
We had just kind of informally listened to this guide, and it turned out now he was going to go in the zone where you have to pay an extra 100 kroner.
Did you not, like, slip him a 20?
I think he was already kind of mad that we had heard his spiel for free in the courtyard. I but see. Guess what? That's what happens when you do a spiel in the courtyard.
That's right. Too bad. Too so bad. Sad.
Maybe you shouldn't have done your spiel in the courtyard.
You know what? If you're Tom Cruise and you don't like people taking your picture, don't walk around outside.
That's your take on Tom Cruise?
I don't know. I was making it up as I go.
So we were kind of, after the tour group left us, and we were like, oh, they're probably seeing something cool because they paid extra. We kind of went into this low door into these kind of dank tunnels that kind of flank the courtyard.
You were like, you know what? We're going to see something cool. We're going into the dank tunnels.
We're going somewhere goth to yeah. mope that you didn't want to hang out with us.
I had this same problem at Versailles. I went and I was like, oh, I came all the way out here to see Versailles. And they were like, it's another 60 euros to see like the potties or whatever. And I was like, oh, man, I don't have another 60 euros.
You missed the Petit Trianon?
Yeah, so I just walked around and looked at the bushes.
The bushes are free?
Free bushes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mitterrand. Thank you, decades of socialist French rule.
Merci beaucoup.
And in these, at one point, you know, we're walking through, I think what used to be, what are they called? Case mats? Is that what the word is for these places that used to be?
Casements.
Casements, is that right? That seems right. You know, that used to be military emplacements. Yeah. Casemates.
Casemates.
Is that a word? That seems like they send you food or it's a dating app.
This may be one of those words where for years I've said casements or casements.
Except casements is a thing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, but casement's part of a window. Casement is that's the fancy hinged window.
Oh, sure. Casement window.
Casemates would be a fortified position or chamber or armored enclosure from which guns are fired.
Casemate.
Yeah. Anyway.
I guess I conflated the two things, and when I would be in castles, I'd be like, well, the casement's over here. And
they could have both.
But nobody ever corrects you because they don't know what it is until you do a podcast and there's 15 people with military history backgrounds.
Listen, buddy.
It's casemate.
In this case, these casemates were kind of low vaulted ceilings, maybe even like dirt floors. And we came around a corner once. There's a large... You know, and usually it's, you know, there's barrels of stuff and an occasional lit explanatory thing saying, this is where they hid out during the siege. Or,
when you say lit, do you mean like rad?
Yeah, there's a rave going on around
it's
the corner.
Totally lit.
No, they're usually very dark. But we came around the corner and there is, I think this was lit in both senses. There's a slightly larger than human scale man.
Ooh.
Sitting on a large chair, throne-like chair, kind of leaning over pensively,
yeah,
kind of with his arms crossed over a sword that is, I think, across the arms of the chair.
Go on.
And he's leaning forward with a long beard, and we were like, "What is that? Why is this at this dead end here?" And a sign told us it was none other than Ogier the Dane.
Ogier the Dane.
Which told us nothing at all.
Right.
But if...
Well, that he was Danish.
Right. And that his name was Ogier.
So there's two things.
Which doesn't sound like a super Danish name. And it turned out that was for a reason. In Denmark, he's Holger Danske. Danish Holger.
Yeah.
Who is a character in the French epic song, the Chanson de Roland, about Charlemagne and his brave paladins.
Sing it.
Well, there once was a man named Charlemagne. The mate was a mighty something. What rhymes with paladin? Saladin?
Yeah. Well, paladin and Saladin, I don't think.
Mandolin?
Paladin and pal within. Gal within.
Gal within.
Gal yeah. within.
Your gal within.
Paladin with a gal within.
And so this is not even a Danish character, it turns out, this legendary king. He was a... He comes from French literature, but the guy, they make the point of like, this guy's from
French
far away.
Literature.
I didn't do that with my fingers. You did that with your fingers. But this guy's from far away Danemark. He's the northerner. So I guess it's like the equivalent of one of these World War II platoons where it's like, here's O'Reilly, here's Moskowitz, here's, you know, Sanchez. And
so what the Danes have
They borrowed him back.
They borrowed him back?
They were the representation was so powerful that they were like, finally, a Dane in the old legends.
Wow. So you think in Ireland they have a statue of like a New York City policeman?
I was thinking it would be the equivalent of like if Mexico loved Zorro, right. You know, like just some totally made up mid-century American thing. Or, I don't know, or like Sergeant or Colonel Klink. Yeah. What if Germany was like Colonel Klink?
Oh, he was such a hero.
I mean, you know, he wasn't a party member for sure.
No, he ended up sabotaging the war in a good way.
and at some point they reappropriated him to the degree that Hans Christian Andersen wrote a beloved story about the noble deeds of this Danish guy who is not real.
How awesome.
He's not even a historical guy. He appears to be a composite between a bunch of kind of Northern European Frankish soldiers.
And was he a figure of fun in the French fantastique?
No, I assume he's got he's very brave. I think he has all the, you know, maybe all the tough qualities of a northerner. Like his Nordic background gives him a kind of, you know, we would imagine is kind of a Viking like barbarian chic, maybe.
The French do this a lot. What about Asterix and
exactly. Yeah. Well, I guess he's a Gaul though, right? He's proto-French. But and the sign explains to us that in Denmark's hour of need, Holger Danske, fictional character from a French song, will rise again from his sleep in this chair on his sword.
Why do the French care whether Holger Danske rises up to save the Danes?
This doesn't appear to be part of the French myth. This is something when Denmark finally got a Danish name on a pan-European hero.
I see.
They decided to add something about their future.
Got it.
And so he becomes this figure that will rise up and say, I don't know what Denmark will be threatened by.
Well, you know, Denmark is,
like
I think,
a shortage of licorice or something.
No, they're roundly despised by all other Scandinavians, as far as I can tell. I mean, I'm not down on the streets of Scandinavia, like getting the pulse of the man on the street.
You're not the Gallup poll of Scandinavian nationalism.
No, but just based on social media posts from Swedes and Finns and Norsks about Scandahoovia, none of them like the Danes. They like each other okay.
The Swedes I knew actually hated Norwegians, and the Norwegians I knew hated the Swedes.
Well, that seems pretty logical. But did you ask them about the Danes?
Maybe they unite.
That's the one time they get along.
If you have actual firsthand knowledge of, a common enemy.
It's the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
It's like the end of Watchmen. You beam a Danish person into the middle of Scandinavia and the war stops. If you have firsthand knowledge of which Scandinavian or Nordic countries actually hate each other the most, please send us a ranked list. But I was interested in this idea that even Denmark has this guy. You know, even they need, and at the time, it didn't say this is all made up French epic poetry. But I was amazed that even Denmark needed to have a national sleeping guy. Everybody has a national sleeping guy. Have you run across the national sleeping guy?
Well, who's the one that fell asleep under the apple tree and slept until his beard was long?
Rip Van Winkle?
Rip Van Winkle. He's a national sleeping guy.
But he's not like, someday Rip Van Winkle will come out of these hills when the Republic is in danger.
Right. Well, what about Sleeping Beauty? She's not a guy, but she is a beauty.
Now, you have thought of people, you've thought of fictional characters who sleep.
Yeah.
But really, isn't that normal? Wouldn't it be odder to think of fictional characters that don't sleep?
Well, but these are like deep sleeps caused by poisoned
apples. These
are
lengthy sleeps. Yeah. Right. So there is the element of the lengthy sleep. And that's a pretty common myth, actually. That's older than this.
Lengthy sleep, I can tell you, is no myth, my friend.
And you've got a beard, even.
That's
right.
Do
you feel like you're the national sleeping guy?
I could be. I'm always looking for a reason to be a national guy of something.
This is kind of a twist on the long sleeping Rip Van Winkle trope, but it's specific to a champion, you know?
Right. Like, so do we have one? Is Uncle Sam asleep?
I mean, he has a beard. But I don't think he has a beard because he's been nodding off and not shaving.
Okay.
I don't know that part of his mythos. But I'm aware of stories like this but not American ones. Like, I think of, like, for example, King Arthur. When you were a kid, did you read Arthurian stuff? Or
no.
Because the T.H. White.
I was too busy playing outside.
You could do both. When it rained, you could come in and read about King Arthur.
I mean, I came in and read about stuff, but it wasn't King Arthur.
Well, you're missing out.
I guess so. I missed out.
He has some crazy adventures.
But he falls asleep?
He falls asleep. You're not aware?
King Arthur falls asleep?
So the he fell asleep a lot. But he, in the end, T.H. White, his version of the Arthurian myth is called the Once and Future King, right?
Oh, right. Okay.
Like, and that's from Malory. Like, in the Mort d'Arthur, like, we see that King Arthur's tomb says, Hic jacet Arthurus, rex quandam rexque futurus. Like, here lies Arthur, the rex quandam, one-time king, rexque futurus, future king. The idea being that... you know, there are myths about his death, so it's a little confusing.
But isn't this just like a return from death story? It's just the Jesus story again.
Well, there's that. There's the more general story of a Messiah, but this is actually not a religious story. You know, we have those. We have Jesus comes back. We have Vishnu will come back in a new avatar. There's a Zoroastrian one. But this is very specific to...
Trump.
To Trump. This is very specific to a leader, to a mortal leader.
Right.
Who... you know, whose stories we all love and who symbolizes our country. But it's not just that, but he's not in the ground. He's actually, in Arthur's case, there's a bunch of places he could be. You know, maybe he's on the island of Isle of Avalon, you know, a mystical river island where from which he will emerge.
So wait, you mean there is a version of this where Arthur is just like a farmer
who's just
living with his farm and waiting for the call?
More typically, I mean, Avalon is kind of a quasi-mystical place. It's like, you know, he went to the Grey Havens or whatever. But
like when Harry Potter dies and goes up and exactly. Dumbledore's there and he's like, no, you could go back if you want.
Is this real or not? And Dumbledore helpfully is like, that's all the same, man. Why are you asking such a... Why are you asking such a bummer of a question?
Yeah, don't be such a bouge.
More commonly, the national sleeping guy is in a cave. In my case, I saw him in a dank tunnel.
Right.
And that kind of, that's the vibe. Avalon is a misty island, but more commonly, Arthur is said to be in all kinds of subterranean places. And this goes back to like in the 12th century, like to this day, like there's these connections between Glastonbury and Arthur. And it's not because...
He loves
it's not because Peter Oasis. Gabriel. Yeah, it's not because Oasis loves King Arthur or vice versa. It's because, like, in 1191, the monks of Glastonbury Abbey were like, "Yeah, we found King Arthur's tomb. He's buried here. No big deal."
Oh, these are like the Ethiopian Jews that found the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, it's always helpful to have the big relic near you. Yeah. You know, to find. You know, you crack open a tomb, and it's not just like, "Look at this old guy." It's like. We did it. We found St. Matthew.
Yeah.
What are the odds that he'd be here in a different continent entirely?
Shards of the True Cross.
And yet, here he is. but it's very regional. Like in England, like the ruined castle of Sewing Shields in Northumberland is said to be where Arthur's tomb is, you know, where he sits. Freebrough Hill in North Yorkshire, Richmond Castle nearby in North Yorkshire, tons of places in Wales, Craigie, Demus, Snowdonia. These are all, you know, anytime there's a hill... It's like, well, that's clearly where the hidden cave is, where Arthur is not just buried, but is sleeping. Is
sleeping.
Because, you know, the greatness of our nation will never die. He'll be back when we need him. So I knew about this first from Arthur, but it's a trope that's it's everywhere. Like in the problem with folklore is nobody was really thinking about it or writing it down. I mean, they thought about it. Nobody was studying it or writing it down.
What do you mean they didn't write it down? Oh, they just sang it to one another
just,
and then...
They're just telling stories at the inn.
Right, right, right.
You're at the inn. There's no TV. There's no soccer on.
And the final person that does write it down is some nuge who's like, somebody had to write this down.
That's exactly what happened, except it's two nuges. It's the nerdy Brothers Grimm.
Oh, those dorks. These
thick glasses, the dorks wandering the forests of Central Europe.
I did read them.
And they have, you know, among all the, you know, they're, you know, we think of them as compiling fairy tales, but really they're just writing down and classifying the stories they were hearing, you know? They were like, somebody's got a, I'm hearing all these stories about a princess that kisses a frog and it turns into a prince. Let's get all the variants of this and write them down so that academics have them. They weren't doing this for kids. And they, the Grimms record two different legends about two great European kings, Charlemagne of the Franks. He might be under Untersberg, a hill near Salzburg, where he's tended by dwarves, the Untersberg Mandolin.
Yep, yep.
Or variously, he's in Bavaria, he's in Nuremberg, and he's their national sleeping guy.
Charlemagne wouldn't go to Bavaria.
It seems like he should be in France.
Yeah, or at least...
When he comes back, he's going to have to cross back into France to defend them.
You know, his tomb...
I mean, he's a Holy Roman Emperor.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Okay.
He becomes a pan-European guy. So in the era of the Eurozone, you know, if too many countries try to Brexit, Charlemagne's going to rise up. I mean, he's already in the Schengen zone. He can cross back into France if he wants.
So are you saying that the Brothers Grimm are like basically collecting the old blues artists in order to preserve them in the Library of Congress?
Yeah, they're what's his name? Alan Lomax or whatever.
I thought that they were...
They were writing these stories.
Or that they wrote them all down just to get rich from them. I mean, you know.
I like that your idea of the Brothers Grimm is that they're like... get rich quick capitalists.
Yeah, they're the Disney of their time.
Kind of a Jordan Peterson type.
But I guess Disney just wrote down all the Brothers Grimm stories.
Yeah, Disney's stealing from them.
Yeah.
No, I think they were genuine scholars.
Scholars.
Yeah.
Oh, that changes my feelings about everything.
And there's a similar myth, and this is maybe the one that is kind of the most central national sleeping guy is none other than Frederick Barbarossa.
The man himself.
The red-bearded German champion. And that his myth centers around a hill called Kyffhäuser, which is in somewhere between Thuringia and Saxony. It's like not. It's in a range of hills not far from the Harz Mountains.
Yeah. It's East Germany. It's the
the former East.
Well, what am I talking about here? I'm talking about the Schwarzwald. No, not Schwarzwald. It's the other one. Never mind.
The Schwarzkopf.
The Schwarzkopf. It's like Goethe land.
Goethelandia.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Goethelandia.
That's a down market European amusement park. let's go to Goethelandia.
Oh, so fun.
I want to ride the Faust Flume.
Yeah.
And the myth is the same, basically, that someday the Germans will be in trouble. And who better to help them than Frederick Barbarossa, who will emerge from his cave, hang his shield on a dead tree, and the tree will spring back to life. New leaves will begin to grow, and a new era of hope will dawn for the German people.
Did you know, now I'm not here to just talk about, like, for instance, walked across Europe, but I did walk the Rennsteig hiking trail, which is through these Thuringian forests. And at the top of one of the little mountains, there was an East German nuclear bunker, like survival bunker for the officers of the squad.
This could be your story.
And I went
with like Erich Honecker in there, bearded and waiting till East Germany needed him to rise again?
Kind of. So I'm there and I go up to the little building and there's a sign that's like, go on a tour of the tunnel. And I walk in, I'm like, I take my backpack off. I'm like, I want to go on a tour of the tunnel. I stand around. Nobody's there. So I walk through a door. I'm like, hello? Nobody's there. Guten Tag or whatever. And then there's a ladder.
I hope you said Guten Tag or whatever.
Guten Tag or
whatever. Gen X slacker.
And so I climb down the ladder. And then I'm down in the bunker. And there's like all these big metal doors or whatever. And I'm just wandering around. Nobody's there. And so I give myself a tour, and then I get back into some, like, back corner, and I hear two people talking who are like, ich bin Schinkenbergerburger, hamburger, hamburger, hamburger.
The Swedish chef was down there?
And it's obvious that they're the tour guides, two young people, who are having some bratwurst or what, they're just, they're
taking
a break.
Is that what they call it there?
Yeah, bratwurst.
Bleh. Oh, I thought you meant there was a little assignation going on down there.
No, it was none of that. You could just hear them chatting. They were just chatting in East German. And I was like, oh no, they're going to yell at me. They're going to want my 20 euros, except it was Deutschmarks then. They're going to want 20 Deutschmarks. And so I like turned around and like kind of quiet, hustled, tiptoed my way all the way out of the bunker. Anyway, it might have been, now I think about it, it might have been a king under the mountain.
What, you thought they were tour guides and they were the...
It maybe, might have been Barbarossa.
They were the Untersberg Mandeln. They were the dwarves guarding Barbarossa, maybe.
It's just as likely as whatever story it was I was telling.
Well, that is what the typical story is. Like before I tell the story that is usually the folktale of the king under the mountain, like let's just say that this legend appears to be widespread. This is why I was so interested when I saw Holger the Dane, and I was like, this is like they just ripped off King Arthur and Barbarossa, you know? What, Denmark doesn't need a king under the hill. Denmark's fine.
Denmark doesn't even have any hills.
Yeah, that's why they had to build casemates. They couldn't find a hill. There is now a ski slope outside Copenhagen.
Right, it's on top of the dome.
It's just the garbage dump.
It's on the dump.
They built the dump into a ski slope.
Power plant slash dump.
You walk up, yeah, I'm sure it's very green, but you walk up there in the summer and it smells like garbage.
Does it really?
Yeah, you can smell that you're on a trash facility.
Oh, every time I see a picture of it, I'm like, those intrepid Danes, like, they're so resourceful.
It is fun because there's really no other, I mean, it's taller than the church towers. It's the only kind of place where you can get a view of Copenhagen, but.
Yeah, but it definitely looks like a thing that you would, like, hike up and not have it smell like garbage.
It's true, but that's the twists, you see.
I see.
Instead of being one of those, It's the other kind of place. Where you walk up and you're like, oh yeah, there's garbage. It looks like
it's full of garbage.
100 feet of garbage.
They're burning garbage or whatever they're doing.
If you were in Ireland, you would hear the same story about Finn McCool. Like Wales.
Come on,
Wales
that's not real. Finn McCool is like a pub.
Finn McCool, yes, but this guy named himself after the pub and became a national hero of a mythical hero of Ireland.
I see.
Because of that, I think it's probably the pub where he got his powers. Maybe. Uh-huh. His parents.
That's true for a lot of Irish.
His parents were murdered in that pub.
Sorry, I didn't mean that.
They got their superpower of sadness and song from alcoholism.
As I did.
There we go. You kind of have an Irish spirit. In Wales, that's a lot of King Arthur talk, because that's maybe where the original proto Camelot was. But in Wales, they also tell those stories about Owen Logoch asleep under the hill or Bran the Blessed. And who has a better story than Bran the Blessed?
They do have a lot of hills in Wales.
Yeah, there could be a king under every hill.
That's right. A king under every hill and a chicken in every pot.
In Switzerland, William Tell is sitting under a hill.
No, he's not.
He absolutely is.
Well, Switzerland's like cornered the market on hills.
And they're big. They're mountains. You could have very tall kings under there.
I know that they have a lot of tunnels under the mountains in Switzerland. It's their survival strategy. When
they can go get all their stolen Jewish paintings out of it.
That's right. When the shit goes down, the Swiss have all their stuff in tunnels and they're just going to disappear from the world.
If you're ever in Istanbul and you see what's left of the golden gates of Constantinople, the old city walls, just keep in mind Constantine XI, who was turned to marble and is now waiting under the golden gates, the marble king, for when the empire needs him again.
Why would the 11th Constantine be the one that we needed?
He was just a really, really good...
A good Constantine?
Constantine, yeah.
Which were the Constantines that we talked about in an early Omnibus episode when we were talking about Greek fire or whatever it was?
Oh, it was the people with the... Wasn't it the people with the fake noses or whatever?
Yeah, the fake noses people.
I don't remember.
There were some Constantines in that
story. Do you think it was this guy?
I don't think so.
In Portugal, it's Sebastian I. The Czechs think that Venceslas is going to emerge on a white horse and he's going to have the sphere, the sword of some great Bohemian hero.
See, I believe that one.
In Georgia, it's the mythical Queen Tamar. So here's finally a queen under the mountain.
There she is.
But there's dozens of, like pretty much all over Europe, you see localized versions of this folktale. Like the guy on the stamps, the guy on the statues, he's going to be back. He's not dead. We just think he is. He's taking a little rest.
So what is it about under the mountain?
Exactly.
What is under the mountain?
Exactly. This comes from, there's two, in a post-Grimm, Brothers Grimm world, there's two ways of categorizing folkloric tropes. This, and they actually give them numbers like it's the Dewey Decimal System, like, 12 dancing princesses who disappear from their room at night. That's entry number 2628, it's like omnibus.
See, back in the days before colleges just taught computer science, this is what colleges did. They produced people that numbered folklore and gave it all designations.
Arguably more important.
You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the backbone of civilization.
And today we just have tvtropes.org for that. You know?
Film majors who are communications majors in college who are like, how do I get a job in advertising?
There's two competing systems of these numberings. The American folklorist is Stith Thompson, and in his system, this is the tale of the sleeping hero is D1960.2.
I'm so glad you know that.
D1960.2. So you can look this up in your Stith Thompson. And it usually is from the point of view of you wandering into your bunker. It's a traveler. It's often a herdsman who has lost a goat, and so he wanders into a strange valley or glen. Or
basically me.
It could be a young potter. Sometimes it's a peasant hauling grain.
Also me.
But some common man journeys into an unsuspected part of the landscape and sees an entrance to a cave. He wanders in, curious. Maybe the goat is in there. And sometimes, in some versions of the story, there's a guide, you know, a dwarf leads him in. I guess there are more dwarfs than usual in this omnibus.
Well, and it feels like, let's say you're a shepherd and you lose a sheep.
Got it.
And you walk into a cave.
Got it.
And there's a dwarf who says, come with me.
I would be like, are you taking me to my sheep? Because if not,
yeah.
No thank you.
Right. I mean, there's a moment there where you have to ask yourself, like, do I go to a second location with Gimli here?
Imagine it's more of a trance. It's a more of a dreamlike thing.
Right.
The dwarf from Twin Peaks is dancing. You're kind of like Sleeping Beauty, just kind of following along in a trance. Free will is now gone because you are no longer a potter or a herdsman. You are part of the story.
I see.
And when you arrive at a chamber, in some versions of the story, there is an alarm clock. There's a horn that will wake up the sleeper. Or sometimes the herdsman character, the goat herd or whatever, bumps into or knocks a suspended bell, which starts to ding, and that can awake the sleeper.
So is this part of the dwarf's plan? Is he leading you in there because he can't roll, but he wants you, the unknowing shepherd, to like break the spell?
In most of the versions, there's no guide, and it's unclear why you would need a guide. Because the upshot is that the traveler comes across a stone table with a man sitting in a chair who the detail is always given that there's an old beard, sometimes to impress upon the listener the supernatural growth of the beard over the centuries. The beard has actually grown through the boards of the table.
Uh-huh.
So it's a real...
Impossible.
A real kind of a blackberry thicket scene in there.
Yeah.
And sometimes the speaker... And it's clearly the guy. This is where the king waits. You know, he recognizes this is Sebastian the First or Constantine the 11th or whoever. And sometimes the man is awoken, and when he speaks, sometimes he will say things like in the Barbarossa legend, he says,
get the hell out of here. I'm sleeping.
It's 20 euros. No. He says, are the ravens still flying around the mountain?
Oh, so he's a CIA agent.
Yeah. Do you know the countersign? No. For whatever reason, he's waiting to be needed. And if you say yes, he's like, then it's not my time yet. And he goes back to sleep.
Oh.
So that's, for whatever reason.
He's waiting for the ravens to have signaled the end times.
Well, you'd think the ravens would be a signal of the end times, but it seems like he's waiting for a cessation of ravens.
Right.
Like the ravens flying around the mountain are normality.
Yes.
And he's waiting for an unusual raven-based occurrence.
Right.
In the story of the three Tells, William Tell and two other compatriots under the mountain.
There are three Tells?
Apparently. And I was looking into this. I was like, are they brothers? Why are they all Tells? I don't know. There's three Tells anyway, under the mountain. And in the Swiss version of this, one of the Tells awakes and kind of blinks at the visitor and says, what time is it on Earth?
Whoa, spooky.
I know, right? And I think he says, well, he tries to remember when he went down into the grotto, and he's like, it's noon? And the Tells are like, not yet. And they go back to their slumber.
Does one of them say, you there, boy, what day is it today?
Put an apple on your head. I'm William Tell. I have a trick I do. So that's the folktale. You know, it's not just that, hey, there's a guy under the earth. It's like, imagine, if you will, a wanderer through the forest, a goat herd, a simple shepherd.
Dig, if you will, a picture.
Who runs across this guy and is surprised that it's a hero. And of course, you know, the fact that this is D1960.2 indicates that there are
other Ds.
Hundreds and thousands of stories like these.
D's nuts.
That's right. That's the name of the system. To me, this is much more interesting than like a girl leaves a party early and loses a shoe, you know, or a witch has a house made of candy. I mean, those are great stories. Those stories, there's a reason why those stories are now in their fifth century or whatever. But like this one's geopolitical. Like this is like the fate of the nation is at stake in this story. Plus it's about futurity and it kind of implies apocalypse. You know, it implies a dangerous time that is coming ahead. Like, it has a lot more weight than most of the grim era folklore. And I started to wonder, like,
Well, the Grimm era folklore is mostly to scare children from going into...
Don't go into the woods.
Yeah, or like, don't go...
Stay on the path, the wolf will eat you.
Don't get into a white van. I mean, yeah, I've definitely dated a few witches that had a house full of candy.
That's,
I wish I hadn't.
That's how they're employed now. I guess they probably were cautionary tales for children. I think that's a lot of the thinking about these tales. But that's not the only thing stories were good for. And children were not the only, maybe not even the primary audience. Because think about this story. This story is not for children.
No. Well, and that's right. You know, the nursery rhymes were all about the War of the Roses or something. So
people think. Wait, we should do an omnibus about that, actually.
Oh, are you a debunker?
I think I might be debunking the debunking.
Are you a ring around the rosy truther?
It's just about flowers, damn it. So I really was digging into this to think like why does everybody, is this something, did it start somewhere and spread and everybody picked their local guy, or is this just universal in the human spirit that everybody wants a sleeping national guy?
I mean, where could a sleeping guy be if not under a mountain? Like if he's on top of a tree,
you'd see him.
Yeah, and he's going to get hit by lightning.
And you know, I think he's in the ground because that's where tombs are. I think, you know, the vibes work.
Right, but if he was buried, he would be dead.
He couldn't get out. The ravens would stop circling the mountain, and he'd be like, hey, let me out of here. Hey, are the ravens still circling?
Hey, you guys!
He'd be like, it's not funny anymore. Let me out of here. So a cave seems like the right place where he's resting, but there's the story of the Rip Van Winkle kind of thing you say about just somebody who's sleep so long there. So often there's a whole army. There's knights, you know, in the cave as well.
Oh, like terracotta soldiers.
Yeah, except they're also kind of decommissioned. They're resting. They're mystically out of commission. But they're going to rise up. He's going to have an army of the past he's going to lead.
This is also very Lord of the Rings. Think about the whole mountain of
the book,
cursed...
what are they called? The Paths of the Dead.
Yeah, the Flimflams, who are like, blah, get out of here. And then Aragorn's like, I'm not scared of you.
Your dad used to work for my dad, so you have to go to work. Yeah. It's a little problematic, Aragorn.
I'll let you retire, but you have to do one last heist.
So the story, the Rip Van Winkle-like story, you know, without the king element, the story is older. In the 3rd century BC, there's a story that's so old that it shows up in Christian and Jewish folklore and in the Quran.
Huh.
Called the Christian version is the Seven Sleepers of Ephesus. And this is a group in a cave asleep, but they are not warriors. They are not champions of the land. In the Ephesus version, they are martyrs. They're Christian converts that won't bend the knee to Roman idolatry. You know, the Romans are like, no, you better worship Jupiter.
Yeah, you better stop it with your Christianity.
Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you crossing yourself? Why are you crossing yourself? So the Emperor Decius says, if you guys don't worship our made-up pagan gods and not your good one, I'm going to put you in a cave. And they're like, oh, no, I think he doesn't say that. I think he says, you better worship Jupiter. And they're like, nope, we're out of here. And they go into a cave. Hopefully there's fewer people who want them to worship Jupiter. Because I've been in a bunch of caves and nobody's ever asked me to worship Jupiter. And
trying to think if anybody has, I mean.
Carlsbad Caverns?
Nobody asked me there.
Maybe the Germans in the bunker were worshiping Jupiter, but you couldn't understand them?
I mean, there's a lot of times I was in caves where I don't have a very clear memory.
You might have been worshiping Jupiter the whole time.
It's something that we used to do, you know, like, oh, I'm not needed here. Maybe I'll go into this cave, wait for the ravens.
Anyway,
you get hungry and
yeah, it doesn't,
damp.
Usually go home and your parents don't even notice you were gone.
Exactly.
In this case, the Emperor Decius is like, well, good riddance. They all went in the cave and he bricks up the cave.
The cask of the Amontillado.
Basically. But the miraculous part of the story, the reason why this shows up in all these books of great deeds starting in the 6th century, I think, is that years later, they unbrick the cave and the saints are still, the martyrs are still there blinking and they're like, hey, it's like a Rip Van Winkle story. They're like, what's changed? And they're like, good news, Christianity is the official religion of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And they go forth rejoicing and it's a miracle that they've been preserved by the hand of God to see a brighter day. Now, this in the Arne Thompson Uti scale, the European folklore classification system, this is myth 776.
Oh, wow. How do we reconcile these two myth classification systems?
Well, this version seems older.
Okay.
The Seven Sleepers, just, you know, kind of the Rip Van Winkle, Sleeping Beauty, you know, sleeper miraculously preserved, emerges blinking into a different time.
This is a lesser 12 days of Christmas.
How
seven
so?
Sleepers sleeping.
I see.
It's just like, oh, that's what a
gift.
Great.
What yeah. a gift. Thank you. So I guess the question I had for myself is this some universal human need? And if so, is this international? Like, if it's only just European cultures, you probably think this is a story that got around and got localized. You know, we'll never know who the Ur story was. But if it's international, and the internet will tell you it is, that these stories are told about King David and lots of, Native American chiefs of the Southwest and the Persian Kay Khosro of Zoroastrian Avestan myth and Japanese Kukai. And I drilled into it and I find myself more and more convinced that these are not actually parallel versions of the same story. For example, the King David one is real. You know, when Israel needs King David, he'll be back. But it's like a Yiddish story from the 19th century. Like it postdates all the Barbarossa stuff.
I've been down into all those tunnels.
And you didn't see?
Nope. I didn't see anybody, really. It's pretty cool in there.
But no King David?
Really narrow, but no King Davids. And I went all over.
The King Khosrow story of this kind of Persian hero emerging with some Cyrus the Great-like hero who has a magical cup that lets you see all the things that are happening on heaven and earth because of his cup. This just seems to be a regular old Messiah kind of a story, like...
He looks into the cup and sees everything?
I guess.
Or he holds the... You were just holding the cup up. Like, how do you see anything in
there? I'm posing for a portrait.
I see.
This is... Here's me with my magical cup of Jamshid.
But you chose wisely.
I think he's like a Galadriel guy. I think he looks into it. But that just seems to be kind of a regular old Jesus or Vishnu, like our Messiah is coming back story. The one of the Japanese guy is a monk, a Buddhist monk named Kukai, who when he died in his monastery of Mount Koya, it was said that he did not die, but actually went into a trance called the Samadhi, and he's just waiting there for the future Buddha Maitreya to emerge. So he is asleep, but he's not a king, and he's not going to save Japan.
So do you put Jesus dying and going into the cave with the rolling back the stone and the whole thing, is it in the same family of stories? It sounds like it.
He's not
dead.
He's okay.
He's dead-ish.
I mean, it's a little more related to ATU-776, but it's really not a D1960.2.
Right.
We got a D1960.
That's what I was thinking.
We got a D1960.2. Barbarossa's in a grotto. He's asking about the ravens over. No, first of all, he only goes in for 3 days.
Right. Okay. So not asleep for a long time.
I mean, the Jesus part of the story is more like he goes to the sky but says he'll be back. You know, that's more of a
different story.
E.T., he'll be back when we need him kind of a thing.
I'll be back.
Yeah, that's what E.T. said, remember?
F*** you, asshole.
I love E.T.'s famous quotes.
Oh, Elliot.
The one international, non-European, and the Native American ones are all, like so much of what we think of as Native folklore, is all just made up colonizer BS. Like,
what?
You said
what?
Well, have you? No. But Hiawatha. Like, have you heard, like, places where the mountain range is said to be a sleeping woman or...
So
Alaska has one of these, right?
Yeah, sleeping lady was my dad could see it from his window at his office, and then he had a painting of sleeping lady next to the window. So you could look out and see sleeping lady, and then you could look at the painting of sleeping lady. In fact, in Anchorage, almost everyone has some kind of picture of sleeping lady.
Or snow globe.
But the mountain's right there.
So you need a picture.
But everybody's got a picture. Because when you see it on a beautiful day, you're like, oh, she looks like a sleeping lady. And you take a picture. And then you develop the picture, put it in a frame, and you go, oh, that's really not as good as it was to see with my eyes.
There's one of these in Utah County. And is it the same in Alaska that over the years, this mountain that looks slightly like a supine person has become conflated with some kind of native legend? Because that's what happened...
I think
in Utah.
The people in Anchorage just love her so much that they don't even bother with like, oh, the natives used to think this. They just are like,
do they want to kiss her?
Kind of.
I wish I was a big sleeping guy that could just be like lowered.
There are so many bush pilots, right? And they all fly over there like, we're going to fly over to Sleeping Lady. And And then you get over there and it's like, oh, it's not a sleeping lady. It's a mountain.
The whole time I lived in Utah, I heard that this this mountain in the Wasatch that, you know, does look like a woman or, you know, seems to be a bit of a profile, you know, was a Ute legend, a tribal legend about a beautiful maiden who blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And it was only in looking into this today that I found out that that was just made up around a bonfire in 1920 by a BYU professor. And I guess I should have known because in the legend, the name of the beautiful maiden is Utana.
Yeah.
Like Utah, Utana, which does not.
And she was a beekeeper, weirdly.
And Red Eagle loved Utana, but oh, she ran from his embraces. You know, it's one of these.
Yeah, Red Eagle. You know, the mascot of my high school was the Thunderbirds, and we had a big Thunderbird mascot, and we...
Is it okay? Like, did they get rid of it?
No, they're still the Thunderbirds, as far as I know.
I feel like Thunderbird's pretty safe. I mean, it's like a mythical creature of a lot of indigenous cultures, but yeah. It's just like dragons or whatever. You're not putting a guy in a headdress.
But it is like done in the style of.
So a lot of those seem like they were bogus and were later influenced by or appended to the National Sleeping Guy myth. Whereas the one that seems a little more on the nose, and I wonder if this is true, because I can't find it earlier than like Western anthropologists in the early 20th century, but there's a lot of myths about Genghis Khan.
Oh.
When he was buried, you know, that certain members of his retinue were in charge of checking his tomb every spring and autumn, and every spring and autumn they would go there, and his clothes would be worn as if he had been up having Genghis Khan-like adventures on horseback.
You know, it's funny, when you were talking about this earlier, I kept thinking of Genghis Khan, and I don't know why, because I have no recall of that.
You've never walked across Mongolia.
I haven't, although it's not too late.
There'll be a break in the podcast while you walk across Mongolia.
It'll take a while. But I guess I had heard that, because otherwise, why would I have been thinking of Genghis Khan the whole time when I could have been thinking of so many other things?
So there are, yeah. How many times a day is the normal amount of times to think about Genghis Khan?
Yeah.
And you know, I guess there were yearly traditions, you know, sacrifices were left, horses were led to his tomb, sacrifices were made at his tomb, you know, rituals were done at his tomb, and horses would wander out of the wilderness. And then at one point, instead of the traditional two horses, one horse rides up and another one has a saddle or something, you know, like.
Did we lose, the location of the tomb, is it lost, or do we know where it is?
I don't think. I bet there is a traditional tomb. I don't know. If it's anything like King Arthur, there is, you know, there's six of them. Yeah, there's possible options that archaeologists argue over, apparently. Right. There is a Mongol sacred mountain, and they built a mausoleum to him in China.
As you do.
But that's not where he really is. So I've kind of come around to the idea that it was some kind of European myth that spread and got localized. Like, well, we want Wenceslas to do this, or even somebody hears a story about it and they're like, oh, if they're talking about a great warrior king, this must have been our guy, Marco or Ladislaw or whatever our Lithuanian guy is.
So you think it was like a spread through colonization and then everybody retconned it back to their own guy?
It just seems incredibly specific. I mean, well, let me ask you this. If it's, yeah, let's jump ahead to this. If this is so universal, you know, America is a country that still builds big marble statues of its mythical founding warrior kings.
Sometimes in mountains.
Sometimes literally in mountains.
Of mountains.
Why do we not think that Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Roosevelt are asleep under Mount Rushmore? To rise again.
Science?
Is that why you think modernity? I mean, the funny thing is this actually persisted into modern days. Like in the 1850s, it was widespread in, I guess, Alsace, to believe that Napoleon was still alive. It was often said among the peasants that Napoleon had not in fact died and that he would, this is very specific, that he would return with the Moors and the Turks.
Huh.
Napoleon's favorite allies.
Yeah, his friends.
Yeah. To overthrow current corrupt powers and once again rule the world. So into the 19th century, you know, peasants commonly believed that
he lived under the mountain. Back.
There was one case where this in fact happened. Where
what?
I don't want to bury the lead.
What?
You remember the three tells, right?
Yeah.
So William Tell's a mythical character of what, like a maybe a 14th century Swiss uprising against the Habsburgs. A few centuries later, a different Swiss peasant war is going on. 1653, okay, now we're in the 17th century. And a bunch of people kind of symbolically impersonated the three Tells and said, it's time to rise up, we're them. And I don't know, it's not clear to what degree they would have been just inspiring, you know, are they inspiring symbols or were they actually believed?
Right. But they were, they like, William Tell wore a crown made of pears, yeah, or whatever.
Dressed as the three Tells, they ambushed and killed a member of the parliament and then successfully were, you know, still in their three Tells gear cosplay, were welcomed back into town as heroes and successfully attended mass as they were cheered on by the crowd. So the myth was actually used successfully in this case. But I mean, there must be something very primal about it, just even if it only caught on all around Europe. Like, what is there that the human spirit yearns for where you want a sleeping guy to come back? It's nostalgia, I guess, right?
Especially with somebody like, I mean, all these people.
Arthur, Charlemagne.
Yeah, I mean, they were problematic in their time.
You mean like they were controversial?
Yeah, I mean, Napoleon wasn't universally beloved.
Right.
So he represents a kind of thing.
The myths may start up later. You know, we don't think this, I don't necessarily think that 6 months after King Arthur died, people were like, I bet he's still around.
Well, that's it.
Because in his time, he was just some chieftain that nobody had heard of 8 miles away probably. But
yeah,
200 years later, that's when it's like, I think Charlemagne's going to come back when we need him.
Yeah, I mean that's got to be it, and it's got to appeal to a certain. I mean, do you think 50 years from now there will be a Donald Trump cult where it is believed that he is living under a rock?
You jumped to the essential conservatism of this idea, which is that we need old timey guys from the strong old timey men,
yeah,
to save us
to come save us
when things were better, because the future is scary. But it's also kind of a hopeful utopian thing. You know, you could see some progressive embrace of like everything will be okay. Actually, you know, like yes, we're in dark times, but I mean, I guess you could read it as, you know, somebody has to be the hero. You know, like. Okay, we all know this is a, you know, these folklore indexes classify this as a story, not a legend. You know, the kind of thing that people would have treated as fiction in their time and not necessarily believed.
Right.
Sure. And obviously that's a big gray area. And, you know, today it's not. You know, today we understand a difference between The Mandalorian and, you know, the Book of Kells.
John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, exactly. But it might have been blurrier back then. So there might have been some implication that, that when you're a kid, you believe in this stuff. But as an adult, you realize that, you know, we need to be the change we want to see in the world.
Right.
But, I mean, when you mentioned Trump, it reminded me that this is kind of a founding principle of QAnon, right?
Sure.
QAnon is maybe the first American movement to have a national sleeping guy. But confusingly, their bearded weirdo is John F. Kennedy Jr.?
Right, who's coming back?
He's actually, despite what you've heard,
this whole time.
He's alive and we need him now, and so he will appear. There's a prophecy that he will appear and unite the nation. It's really our first attempt at a peasant's movement of a king under the mountain.
I'd never thought about that.
But what a weird guy to pick, right? I mean, well, you can see why Elvis works in that vein. You know, he was
a hero to most.
he's a national cultural figure, but there's something so random about picking JFK Jr. instead of MacArthur or, you know?
Well, but, you know, JFK Jr. died in a way that is implausible. He was young and also had somewhat failed to yet achieve what we all hoped he would achieve, which is to become an eminence grease and then run for president and save us all.
Dynasty.
Yeah, bring Camelot to fruition. And so that, you know, his potential energy.
It is king-like.
Yeah. His return, because right about now, right, he would be the age that we would be expecting him to be president of the USA or have been or have become king of the USA by now, right? JFK Jr. would be 65 now?
Yeah, probably older, right? Yeah. No, wait, how old is he at the funeral? He's like four or five, like so five. Born in the late 50s?
Yeah, so yeah, he'd be,
he'd be 65, yeah.
65. Yeah. So he's like, you know, a little late to be president even. He would have been president.
But do any of these people, you know, thinking of him as a king, as a warrior king figure, do they remember how he functioned in the 80s and 90s as kind of a just a...
Playboy?
Yeah, celebrity playboy.
Yeah, but that's
dilettante who, magazine editor. You know, it's like thinking that Graydon Carter is going to be...
But that's what Trump was in the 80s.
I guess that's true. Yeah, I guess I didn't think about that.
The 80... Playboys from the 80s are who we want to run our country now.
It's just weird because I feel like the generation of people who are the most QAnon-pilled would be the least likely to be super into JFK Jr. when he was... They weren't like John heads when they were alive.
But this is
when
the he was thing. Alive. They were, because that generation has gotten increasingly conservative over the course of their lives, right? They were the hippies.
Yeah, that's true.
And then in the 80s, they were like the Miami Vicers.
I guess it's... we do... The American version of this is probably just the Captain America myth, right? This guy from our finest hour defeating the Nazis. You know, he'll come back. This happens in the comic books. He comes back and he's deployed in McCarthyism times. He's deployed in Watergate times. He's deployed in Gulf War times, war against, you know, post 9/11. And he becomes like, you know, we need the moral clarity of that age of hero today.
Well, we have a lot of those peasant uprising, like Rambo types. Rambo didn't exactly go live in the mountain for 1,000 years, but he did.
He was off the grid.
Go yeah. into the mountain.
Right. He's hunting deers with bow and arrow or something, yeah. like William Tell. Yeah, he's putting apples on their heads.
How interesting. I wonder, though, if we're entering a new era of men under the mountain.
Just as a final footnote, I looked into that statue I saw under the castle, under Kronborg Castle, and it turns out that it's not any kind of historical relic. In the year 1907, after Hans Christian Andersen's story had introduced Ogier the Dane to actual Danes for the first time, and he became a hero, he was associated with Kronborg, so they wanted to put him in a nearby hotel lobby, and they commissioned a big bronze of him to sit in the lobby, you know, just waiting to rise again. And the original, I guess, plaster cast that was used for the bronze needed to go somewhere, and they were like, well, we'll just put it under the castle. So it's just like a leftover artist's prop.
Whoa.
I think at some point it got replaced with a concrete one because the plaster started melting. But yeah, it was just placed there in the 20th century.
Because that was a leftover damp place that nobody was using anything. And now exactly. It's become a thing.
So maybe the whole thing is just as manufactured as the...
It was already manufactured and now it's double manufactured.
But even made of plaster, you know, in Denmark's darkest hour, when Viggo Mortensen cannot save us, maybe Holger will be back.
He'll be back.
Just like E.T. said.
And that concludes The King Under the Mountain, entry 688.RO1311, certificate number 53610, in the omnibus. Futurelings, social media is not serving you. It isn't serving me. It doesn't serve Ken, although probably more than you and me. Just because Ken sits on top of the world.
I guess I just realized this show will drop for Tuesday people on Election Day. Is that true?
On Election Day?
Yeah.
Hey!
This may be the... that's who will rise up.
Go out and vote.
It may be... This may be the omnibus that only Tuesday people get to hear because... The country will have fallen by the Thursday release.
Well, those of you listening on Thursday, I hope you voted well. And I hope that the election has, the results have been tallied and it's uncontested. A clear victor was announced.
It's unclear how many different American nations there are at this point. But for those of you in the Cascadia Alliance still listening to our words, thank you.
Well, let's see. Talking to this future world... That we're so excited about. Maybe you should go to at Omnibus Project for a little bit of respite from all the yelling.
Maybe Elon Musk has fallen and Twitter is good again. We don't know.
At Ken Jennings and at John Roderick, it's almost guaranteed that Ken and I will be voices of reason and we will be relaxed and confident about the future.
Speaking of the future, I just remembered now that I told you that last week's show would be the Halloween show and you did New Urbanism.
I know. What was I thinking?
It's very spooky.
I should have done a Halloween topic, like ghosts or
I guess we mentioned
zombies.
We mentioned Stepford Wives.
Yeah,
that's kind of spooky.
I mean, my
not a real spooky Halloween show this year.
Yeah, I mean, next
year
thing.
For sure.
When those things fall on a show that you're doing, you always think of that stuff. But I'm just like, oh yeah.
I texted you just in case you had a spooky idea, well, but apparently you did not have a spooky idea.
I don't
have
spooky ideas. All my ideas are not spooky. We recommend that you email us. I think everyone listening should go right now to their computers and email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with whatever it is you want to say, whatever it is you want to tell us, whatever questions you want to ask. You can, if you don't want to address us directly, which is actually my recommendation, you should go then instead to Facebook to hang out with the futurelings and ask questions of them and maybe start little conversations about things. Who is the man under your mountain? If you don't go to Facebook and don't like it at all and you don't want to email us, why don't you send us something interesting to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. Send us your ballot. Send us all your ballots.
Here is a follow-up to last week's... just send us your ballot. If you voted Republican in a swing state, send your ballots to us. If you didn't, please put them in a ballot box. You may recall last week we received our 98155 postcard after our 98133. But I just found out that 98144 did arrive, but it has a little please forward sticker on
it. Oh.
So you can get a podcast, you can get a postcard to us at 98144, but it will annoy postal employees.
Please forward. I wonder how they knew where to forward it to. Isn't that P.O. Box?
Maybe there's no.
Dictated exclusively by the.
There must be other P.O. Box 55744s, but maybe that's the only one in the area that has.
Oh, it does say Shoreline.
Oh, it does say Shoreline. You're right. Okay. Let's see. We also got a postcard from Ariadne.
Oh, yeah.
Who sent us a gravy recipe. We were, apparently we complained that gravy doesn't taste meaty enough because there's never enough drippings in the pan to actually make gravy taste good.
So what's her solution?
She has a recipe that does not need drippings.
You know, she lives in Kansas City where there's drippings running down the streets.
Where does Ariadne?
Oh, no, she's moved. She's moving to Colorado. She lives in Colorado.
Oh, you know who this is?
Oh, yeah.
I was like, wow, that's correct. She does live in Colorado. You have control of the board. How did you know that? She's
a friend of the show and a friend of mine.
Oh, I see.
What? What does she say?
It says, John, bring this. Stop the gravy guff from Ariella's father. I guess that's outed her a little bit. But she sent us a recipe that's based on whole wheat flour, nutritional yeast.
Good grief.
And then various seasonings, including vegetable broth and soy sauce. So this is
a vegan
gravy.
Although, is it gluten-free? No.
It's heavily favored by my Thanksgiving crowd. And are you aware of this Thanksgiving crowd? Do you feel like they will? It's not gluten-free.
I don't know her Thanksgiving crowd.
They all hate the giblet gravy that's always met out of obligation. Wow, are we going to have to try that this year?
I guess so.
Are we going to have to try vegan gravy?
Can we make it side by side with regular gravy and see a taste test?
I think you want to have the regular gravy there just in case. But she actually filled out an index card for each of us so we can put it in our recipe files, which I know you have.
Well done, my dear.
Let's see. And this note is from Steve in Massachusetts. He's even though he lives in Massachusetts, he's Canadian born and loved the poutine entry. But he disagrees with our nomenclature of calling the original poutine service a food truck. Back then, they would have been called chip wagons, at least in his Ottawa. What's the adjective of Ottawa?
Ottawan.
Octavian?
Oh,
Ottawan childhood. And he includes a photo of a chip truck, just so we can picture.
Yeah, it's a food truck. You would call that a food truck, wouldn't you?
Yes, but not there.
I see.
There, it's a chip wagon.
A chip wagon. Well, but what if they serve something other than chips? See, we... food is more inclusive.
He went to the Ottawa Costco just to send us pictures of a big bucket of poutine that they sell at Costco size there. He did not. He says he did not buy the poutine of sauce mix, despite being the bucket of sauce mix, despite being tempted to do so. Oh, here's the Costco photo. What do we have here? Oh, you can get giant $21 bags of cheese curd.
Oh, my God.
And then a bucket of sauce to put on top of it.
Oh, no.
That's how you got to keep your chip wagon running.
Crime against humanity.
And in fact, Steve and his son made some poutine for dinner during a trip to Canada earlier this year, and it was delicious. They added some chicken to the poutine, as you can see.
So I like that.
It's a healthier poutine. It's got some protein.
Oh, that's healthier, you think. Put chicken on it.
I would say if you're going to eat French fries and gravy, or if you're going to eat French fries, gravy, and chicken, the chicken version is healthier.
French fries, gravy, cheese, and chicken.
I guess the cheese has some protein. Protein? Is it called protein?
Protein.
If there's protein in poutine?
Now that I think about it, the food truck, the one food truck in Anchorage in the 1980s was Benny's Taco Wagon. So wagon might have been... long before food truck, every place called it a wagon.
Well, it seems to kind of convey its carnival roots.
Right.
Right? You would not buy... I guess there's... Do you call those hot dog wagons, the little push carts on the streets of New York, or do you not?
I think you call them wagons. You don't call them trucks.
Do you call them carts? If they're carts. Small enough, they're carts.
Hot dog cart.
Hmm.
But I do feel like wagon is more evocative. Chip wagon sounds better than food truck, but food wagon doesn't sound
food
right.
Wagon sounds like a discount grocery store.
Does
get food wagon, it's cheaper.
Futurelings, on a final note, let me suggest that you go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and support the show with a pledge that more than pays for itself in terms of
happiness,
content, contentment.
Happiness and content are the same to me. Yeah. Content, you say it differently and it means happy.
Content
makes me content. Not you. You hate media.
I hate media and I hate being content. I'm
That's
made
why.
By God to be dissatisfied.
Like they're making you watch some TV show and you're like, this is so good. I hate it.
Yeah. I mean, when I wake up in the morning, I go, ugh. And then I say, no, not ugh. And I go, ugh, okay. And that's how I start every day. Ugh. No.
And you land
and
on,
I go, ugh, okay.
You land on ugh. Okay.
All right. Okay, fine. Not ugh.
That's something to aspire to. Okay, fine. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if it does, we certainly hope someone has been napping all this time who can fix it.
Yeah, JFK Jr.
Disney frozen in Forest Lawn. Einstein in a jar in Princeton. Somebody.
Bill Tell.
Three tells. We're going to need more than three tells this time. Six or seven tells at a minimum.
6 to 7 tells.
6.5 tells. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, should I wish everybody some Costco-sized cheese? Costco-sized goods and cheese?
Why not? What's the worst that can happen?
I think I've never done it before. But in any event, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.